This is the Infotainment Podcast, the vaccine to the disinformation virus. Facebook has been under attack from current and former employees for not taking responsibility for harmful content on the platform, and unlike Twitter, failing to take a stand on Donald Trump's messages during the protests about the death of George Floyd. Also, as the UK watch protesters in Bristol tear down the statue of the 18th century slave trader Edward Colston, a hashtag defund the BBC campaign caught alight on Twitter. I'm Damien Collins MP, and I'll be discussing these and other issues with Yale Eisenstadt, who for 13 years worked in the US government as an intelligence officer, diplomat, and White House advisor, and then between June and November 2018 was Facebook's global head of elections integrity ops for political ads. She is currently a visiting fellow at Cornell Tech's Digital Life Initiative. Alongside Yale is Jason Kint, the CEO of Digital Content Next, based in Washington, D.C. We'll also be hearing from our resident experts, the disinformation analyst Dr. Charles Creel and John Quinlan, the CEO of Iconic Labs. Yale Eisenstadt, it's fantastic to have you with us on the podcast. We've followed the things, your interviews and the things you've written about disinformation, Facebook, election integrity over the last couple of years. And there's so much to talk about. But I wondered if I could start with the period when you started at Facebook in June 2018, because obviously for us, that was such an interesting period of time. We were heavily involved in the Select Committee inquiry looking at disinformation. The Cambridge Analytica scandal had just broken. I think we'd just had or were about to have the evidence session with Mike Schreck from Facebook in the House of Commons. It must have been an incredible time to be joining Facebook, particularly with the responsibility to look at election interference and election integrity on social media.
Thanks for inviting me to talk about this. Yes, it was a really interesting time to be hired. Facebook had reached out and started speaking to me just a little bit before the Senate hearing where Mark Zuckerberg testified, the famous Senate hearing. We went back and forth, but they actually made the final offer to me a minute after the Senate hearing ended. So I knew the gravity of what I was going into. Obviously, one of the biggest themes of that hearing was the Russian interference in our 2016 elections and Facebook's many mea culpas, and we will do better. So I came in sort of in that atmosphere. So when I joined, by the time I got there in June 2018, so I was on the political advertising side, and they had really scrambled to put together responses to these vulnerabilities that they allowed to be manipulated on their platform. Again, I was on the advertising side, but they had scrambled to put together these plans to, I mean, yes, they make sense, but sort of surprising they hadn't done this already. Things like making sure that people could not purchase political advertising paying in rubles for elections in the United States, verifying that people who are actually buying political ads actually resided in the country where they were purchasing them, things like that. And so I walked into just that environment where all eyes were on Facebook. You can't let this happen again. What are you going to do to fix it? And my mandate was to come in, and there wasn't a team yet in the business integrity organization specifically dedicated to elections integrity. And so they asked me to come and build and start this new team to really look at ensuring that the advertising mechanism at Facebook, and to be clear, I actually don't think the advertisements on Facebook themselves are the biggest problem, but they are clearly one of the problems. And while everyone likes to say, oh, but the Russians didn't even spend that much money on ads, it's A, the fact that they let them at all, and B, we can get into this throughout the conversation. It's how their advertising tools work and how, you know, political operatives are allowed to target their messages and all of these things. And so I walked into that big mess to try to with the mandate of ensuring that Facebook's advertising tools would not be used to manipulate elections globally, not just in the United States.
And when you started that role, I remember when we, I'm interested to know what your views on how serious you think Facebook were about tackling this, because I remember when we met with one of the Facebook representatives in the UK, and this was shortly after the Senate Intelligence Committee had published the evidence of Russian ads that had been targeted. And I asked what I thought was not an unreasonable question of Facebook, was to say, well, is there any evidence of similar activity in the UK of people buying ads from Russia in rubles to target people with political ads in the UK? And their response to that was, I thought, quite astonishing, which was to say that, well, if you found evidence of that, then you bring it to us and we'll look, but it's not our responsibility to check. And I remember in February 2018, when I was in Washington, relaying this conversation to Senator Warner. She thought it was very funny because he said, we never went to them with evidence of it. We eventually managed to persuade them to look for what we thought was the kind of lowest of the low-hanging fruit, and then they reluctantly did. And for me, thinking back to that time, there was a very strong sense that Facebook were reluctant to take any kind of responsibility or believe that responsibility should be placed on them to analyze and research what was going on the platform. And at the time, the example we used was to say that if you were a bank and you took that attitude towards money laundering, you'd probably lose your banking license. But a tech company seems to be under no real obligation to identify illegal activity on its own platform.
Right. And now you're getting to the core of the issue, and the one that I would never, ever have been able to have any influence on while working there. And that is that there is no responsibility for a company like Facebook to proactively ensure that their platform's not being manipulated. I mean, the only in terms of how the US manages these companies, the only responsibility they have is for very clear criminal behavior, intellectual property rights, a few very specific, this isn't crystal clear how this responsibility is either, but in terms of like child trafficking. But in general, the whole point is that these platforms continue to enjoy this blanket immunity from taking any responsibility for what happens on their platforms. And so I always found it really interesting might be an understated word. When I worked there, all of the things we were putting in place and all of our solutions, to me, really felt like we were taking actions, A, to address the threat of the past, fine, to make sure Russians can't pay for ads in rubles. We were taking no proactive action. And by we, again, I want to be really clear. I'm talking about the part of the business I worked on. Facebook is huge. And that's another thing people don't understand is, what one group might be doing in newsfeed integrity versus what one group might be doing on policy versus what we're doing on the ad side are not all necessarily equal. But what we never did was, or at least in my opinion, we never put together policies and operations that actually proactively put it on the company to ensure that bad behavior wasn't happening. And I'll give you an example. I'm going to talk a little bit lightly here because I don't want to go into too much detail about some of the things I worked on. But if another country came to us and said, it is illegal in our country for our elections for any political party to spend more than X amount of dollars on their campaigns, and therefore we want to ensure that Facebook does not allow any party to spend more than this amount. Or let's say there's a blackout, Facebook, we want to make sure that during our blackout period, you do not allow political advertising to happen. During my time, when I was in some of those meetings with some of those government officials from other countries, the answer was, yes, we understand those are your laws. We will respect your laws. If you see ads that violate your laws on our platform, let us know and we will look at it and take it down. That is very different than saying, we will ensure that there are no ads on our platform breaking your laws. Right? Those are two very different things. You find it, you alert it to us, we will look at it and take it down, but we will not take the proactive responsibility on ourselves of making sure that that violating content is on our platform. And now, you know, in retrospect, I realize it just seems very obvious to me. Why would the company want to take proactive responsibility to ensure that bad content isn't on its platform while still arguing for Section 230 immunity to say we are not responsible for the content that other people post on our platform? And so I really believe that is why our answers always sounded like, yes, we respect your laws and we will ensure that this is not happening, but it's up to you to tell us. We're not going to proactively do it.
Yeah. And that's particularly difficult when ultimately Facebook as an entity is the only body that can really see what's happening on the platform. And I always felt when people said, well, you know, there are so many data points, there's so much happening all the time, how can we possibly monitor everything? And I sort of think, well, you know, you do it to run ads, you know, you gather that data to target advertising. And therefore, I think you probably do have the capability if you wanted to or believe you should take responsibility. But I want to ask just specifically on our policy. One of the things that we were concerned about, and indeed the Information Commissioner in the UK has even questioned the legality of this, is the use of inferred data to target political ads. So whereby someone chooses not to reveal their political affiliation on their Facebook profile, but nevertheless Facebook guesses what that is and sells that data to other people through the lookalike audience function. I noticed that last year YouTube, their similar product customer maps, they've now removed from political ads, so you can't use it to target people. And do you feel that tools like lookalike audiences on Facebook should similarly not be available for political advertisers?
So I absolutely believe that lookalike audiences should not be allowed for political advertising, and I'll explain that a little bit. Just for people who don't really know what a lookalike audience is, if I have, I'll put this in layman's terms, if I have an email list of people that I have gathered through my business who I know are mostly women between the ages of 40 and 50 who like cats, I can upload that email list and Facebook will find matching personality profiles. And that would be the lookalike audience. So part of the reason I think lookalike audiences and hyper-targeting and targeting beyond basic, listen, I understand that targeting is going to happen in political ads, and it's always happened. It's happened in mailing flyers, it happened on cable TV, but there's a difference between a news station running an ad targeted to its local affiliate and that whole state or that whole city, and being able to get down to the granular of, you know, what Cambridge Analytica called persuadables, right? Of saying, well, I'm going to target this particular ad to African-American communities in the inner city between this age and that age. I mean, the more granular you get, not only are you able to send really targeted messages, but also the rest of the country or even the city or even the neighborhood doesn't get to see that same political message. And so if democracy is all about us being able to, you know, as Facebook has said, actually, the reason we don't fact check politicians is because political speech is the most scrutinized speech already. And my argument against that is it can only be the most scrutinized speech if we all get to see it. If my next door neighbor is seeing a completely different message than I'm seeing, then the two of us can't meet in the hallway and discuss it and debate it and figure out how we each feel about the people trying to represent us. So you have this dual thing now of these hyper-targeted ads that can target you based on any number of traits, combined with a policy saying we will allow politicians to lie in ads. Those two things combined, in my opinion, completely destroy the idea of a public square, of open democratic debate, of a free and fair election, of scrutinized political speech.
And this I think takes us to seems to become an increasingly hot topic within Facebook as well. It's been really interesting, I think, to see the number of former and even some current Facebook employees that believe that Mark Zuckerberg has got this wrong in terms of stepping back from taking some sort of action over misleading and harmful political speech.
Yeah, it's been a really interesting few weeks. For some of us who've been screaming about this for a while, there are people who listen to us and there are people who say, you just sound like a disgruntled former employee, or you just like to scream about Facebook. But boy, have I received some messages from people I don't know recently, pardon me, who work at Facebook, who say, I've heard you for the last year and a half, and now I finally understand you. And it is interesting. I think three major things have happened over the last however many months that have really shown a light on this isn't actually about clear-cut policies, and this isn't actually about Facebook wanting to ensure they're protecting their platform against misuse. This is 100% about what Mark Zuckerberg's going to decide. First, you had the decision back in October, around that time frame, to allow political candidates to lie in ads. That was very clearly in reaction to Donald Trump running ads that had manipulated synthetic audio, maybe video, I can't recall, of Vice President Biden and Mark Zuckerberg saying, we're not going to fact check politicians. So that was the first wave that made some employees very upset. There was an internal dissent memo that leaked to the press. People were really surprised because you either have a policy or you don't. If you have a policy, but then you amend it to fit certain candidates, then you don't. And then the second thing that happened was last week, my gosh, every day feels like a year now. It was either a week or two ago. The whole debacle where Twitter added a little tagline to one of President Trump's tweets, which in my opinion, and I will say this emphatically, engaged in voter suppression. It was a tweet that gave misinformation about voting processes in the United States, giving false information about mail-in ballots. So Twitter put a label at the bottom of it, didn't censor it, didn't even unboost it, didn't say we won't allow this to spread, we won't allow you to comment. All they did was put a little tag at the bottom that said, get information about mail-in ballots. Facebook decided to do nothing. Now, that was the second thing that got some employees starting to say, well, wait a minute, because if we have a policy about voter suppression at Facebook, why are you making an exception for Donald Trump? A policy is only carries as much weight as the enforcement of that policy. And the voter suppression policies, I want to be really clear as well, because I don't think a lot of people in the public know this, only came about because there was a civil rights audit that happened of Facebook while I was there in 2018. Up until that civil rights audit, these policies were not happening. So that was a second thing. And then the third catalyst this week was Mark Zuckerberg deciding that he would allow Donald Trump's post that clearly was inciting violence against looters, which Twitter put behind, if you try to look at that tweet, you get this message that this tweet incites violence or violates their violence policy. And Zuckerberg decided to keep it up and also went on Fox News to describe why. So those three things have made it crystal clear that no matter how many times you want to talk about what Facebook's policy should be, how should they handle abuse on their platform, look at us, we've taken so many steps, we've created all these policies. When you make it crystal clear that you are not going to enforce those policies because you do not want to get on the wrong side of the President of the United States of America, then it is time for us to understand that these policies, these self-made policies, mean nothing. And so there are some employees who clearly are starting to see that no matter how much work they do, let me be clear, there were many people when I was there too who really passionately wanted to do the right thing. But when you're at a company that claims to be from the bottom up, that claims to be a flat company, and you realize all the hard work you've done to try to put in policies to protect elections integrity mean nothing because Mark Zuckerberg has the final word on how he will enforce them, I think that's a bit of a turning point for the company.
Absolutely. I mean, just a final question for me before bringing in Jason Kint. When we were holding the sessions with Facebook, I always noticed that they always responded in terms of activity on pages and activity on advertising. And they were almost scrupulous in ignoring groups when responding to our questions. And I remember asking them about this, and the response from Facebook was, well, the only way you can drive content through the platform is for advertising. You can't do it organically. But I think there's now a much bigger focus on the role of networks, of groups, and closed groups on Facebook for pushing political content through the platform. And I wondered whether that was something that you'd looked at alongside looking at ads as well.
Yeah, so I didn't personally work on that directly, but it was definitely part of some of the conversations, especially when I was overseas. Pardon me. And people would tell us, we would engage with users, with government agencies, with others, and they would tell us, but you understand what's happening, right? You have a page or a group that started out as one thing, gathered millions of followers, and then was bought by someone else or completely changed its stance. And now suddenly content, I'll just make it up. Let's say I followed a group of moms who like knitting. I'm neither a mom and I don't like to knit, but let's say I was part of that group. And then all of a sudden I started getting content pushed, or I liked a page. Let's even say it that way. I liked a page for moms who like knitting. And for a while I'm getting information about that. And then suddenly I start getting information in my newsfeed about whatever it is, whether it's anti-vax ads or whether it's political messaging from a certain party. And it's really important that we understand that this is what was happening with both pages and now seems to be happening with groups. I don't give credit to Facebook often, but I will when they do. I do think they recognize that now and are trying to figure out what to do about that. But if you saw just recently this whole debacle about Facebook trying to tell group moderators how they should moderate conversations within groups, it's just, again, putting the responsibility on somebody else. It's not Facebook saying, we will not allow this to happen with our pages. We will not allow this to happen in groups. And I do think on the security side, I think they have made a lot of efforts to try to tackle some of these things. I think there's a real difference between some of the security folks who are trying to do this and the policy folks whose job it is to ensure that the people in power do not regulate them, whose job it is to ensure that they are playing diplomats. So as you can imagine, there's a real tension there.
Absolutely. Jason, thank you for joining us as well from the East Coast of the United States. Well, I assume that's where you are. Are you in New York or Washington at the moment?
I'm in the Washington area. Thank you for having me, Damien.
Well, it's great to have you with us. How does it, from your perspective, does this feel like a turning point in the discussion on the policy approach towards companies like Facebook around the whole question of intervening and challenging on decisions around speech? It seems to us, I think, that one of the effects of coronavirus has been, I think, to bring forward the whole debate around speech that can cause harm and the tension between free speech and causing harm. I mean, do you think that the whole range of issues that are gripping America at the moment, that this debate is moving in a new and interesting direction? Or do you think companies like Facebook will just hope that this passes and then carry on as before?
Good question, and thank you for the conversation so far. I've been enjoying it, and both you and Yael's understanding of this industry is so far, I think, beyond the conventional discussion that's out there. So these conversations are incredibly important, and we are seeing progress. But I hate to sound cynical, particularly in the moment we're in, but most people are also living these issues. And so when I look at what's actually driving change, it's going to drive change, is the fear of antitrust scrutiny, which is absolutely happening now, not only abroad, but across all of our states here and within our federal authorities. And that's the only thing that's going to, that along with a couple different regulatory risks, certainly on the liability for the content on their platform that is a third rail for them. And so is data regulation and privacy regulation is also a big concern for them. But the antitrust investigations, especially across our states here, have their attention for sure.
There's also, I think, been this very interesting debate that started around Section 230. It seems that Donald Trump started it for different reasons, and that most people that raise concerns about the fact that the tech platforms have got this protection from liability for harmful content is that they use that protection not to intervene enough. And obviously, Donald Trump's concern is they're using that to intervene in ways he doesn't like. But you know, do you think that is something that there seems to be a growing cross-party consensus for maybe for different reasons in America that this blanket protection from liability the companies have is wrong and needs to be reformed? And I mean, again, do you think there is an attraction around that argument now?
I think there's attraction around that modifications need to happen, and that was written over 20 years ago may no longer be what is needed. And I think that's a pretty bipartisan discussion to amplify. But to be clear, throwing it out entirely also creates a lot of concern to a number of different stakeholders, even in some cases, the press and the news organizations. And so modifications, changes, but not necessarily throwing it out. The one thing I would also amplify, and no pun intended on that, I apologize, but something Yael said about how Twitter handled a circumstance by adding a label to a president's tweet, to a tweet from the president. That is, you know, it's not censorship. And the discussion around Communication Decency Act and the idea of whether or not the platforms should be liable for any individual post, et cetera, that censorship discussion really gets very partisan quickly. And the thing that we're much more focused on and where we really think the modification should be focused is on the amplification, on what in the core platform of a social media company provides velocity and reach to this content. That's the tools that both make the advertising work and makes them so profitable, but it's also what makes the content spread. And so if it's synthetic content or false information, rather than just focus on should that be on the platform or not be on the platform, let's focus on what actually makes that content spread. When Nancy Pelosi, when the speaker's the post of her video that was clearly doctored spread like wildfire, Facebook didn't actually do anything about it, according to the reporting, for nearly 24 hours. And so the algorithms were what made that spread so quickly across the platform. And that's where we really feel that the social media platforms need to do a lot more work and maybe should have liability because they're making the recommendations. They're actually amplifying and giving the, as you've described it, the reach to it rather than just the speech.
Absolutely. And one issue that sort of intrigued me recently is that we're having starting a debate really about Section 230 in the UK because there's concern that there'll be an attempt made to include this in the UK-US trade agreement, just as it was in the trade agreements between the US and Mexico and Canada. And when you look at the sort of chronology of this policy, it's something that seems to that came forward with the Trump administration. The idea of including Section 230 in trade agreement between the EU and the US, the TTIP, Transatlantic Trade Agreement, didn't exist there. It wasn't in NAFTA. And it's sort of intriguing that it seems to be under the Trump presidency that there's been an attempt made to shoehorn these provisions into other trade agreements. And I wonder whether that was something that people have discussed in America and whether there's a reason why the current administration would be so keen on supporting this.
Yeah, I think that's a very good observation. And I think it is what happened. And, as somebody who works on behalf of making sure that the news industry of the future and that publishers of the future have a business that values quality and content, it was very alarming when it happened. And I don't think that the presidents and the administration did that on their own. There are significant lobbying interests for the tech companies in particular Google and Facebook, that have their checkbooks and their influence in much of Washington and much of the industry and much of the publishers even. You know, everybody depends on these two companies. And so, you know, it was alarming at that time because while Facebook and Google, to a lesser extent, were out there saying that, yeah, regulation probably needs to happen in certain ways, and we want to be helpful to make sure that there's the right type of regulation. At the exact same time, they were helping to tuck in this language in the trade agreement that would actually make it very difficult for any changes to CDA 230 and their liability protection down the road. And as much as they try to do that now with the UK too, that's very concerning. But I don't think that was just the White House moving independently. I think it was influence and lobbying from the tech companies likely to try to, in a place that most people wouldn't be looking, to help to protect their interests for at least a few more years.
Yeah, it's very interesting. Now, I'd like to start to bring in Charles and John, who are with us as always. Charles Creel, what's caught your attention over the last few days?
Hi, Damien. A couple of stories have got my attention right now. One is about Black Lives Matter trolls. There's a battle brewing on 4chan and Telegram. One side are anti-police violence and Black Lives Matter protesters, and on the other side are white supremacists and alt-right trolls. And just to be clear, alt-right is the polite term for neo-Nazi. In this battle, the protesters are gravitating toward Telegram. Now, that's a secure private messaging service also used for group chat, and the protesters are using it to organize. But the alt-right have been using 4chan to organize against the protesters. 4chan is like Reddit for neo-Nazis, and users have been pushing other users to infiltrate the protesters' Telegram channels and then gather information about protesters and organizers. What's interesting is their focus doesn't seem to be on harassment yet. They're advocating for information gathering, saying be stealthy, don't troll, the most valuable thing we can get is info. But based on typical 4chan group behavior, this usually turns into doxing, publishing protesters' names, phone numbers, addresses, and so on. And targets of this information gathering also appear to include safe houses for protesters. Now, the protesters are trying to counter this insurgency on one protest channel called the BLM Revolution of 2020, which has almost 9,000 users. Its moderators attempted to reach out to, quote, the fascists who are watching this channel and to appeal to their better nature. The other story I've been watching is Homegrown. It's a defund the BBC campaign. But this is an AstroTurf campaign that's been running on Twitter. Although there are several legitimate movements to undo the BBC, this one is being led by an account with the at handle defund BBC. The account was set up Sunday, that's the 7th of June, and within 48 hours had nearly 60,000 followers, so nothing suspicious there at all. I did a quick trawl through their followers, and I'd say that 80% are easily fake accounts or bots. But the whole campaign was revealed by a disinformation specialist named Mark Owen Jones. He says the director of the campaign is James Usel, who's a student at Glasgow University. Two other related accounts were set up within 24 hours. All three accounts are running similar generic messages. But what Jones did, which is really interesting, is he developed a graph analysis of the Twitter swarm surrounding the campaign. He looked at nearly 20,000 tweets from 12,000 accounts and found that most of the storm was created by retweeting defund BBC. But the second most retweeted account in the swarm was the account of Lawrence Fox, the actor from Netflix's White Lines and famously from Question Time. Fox has been retweeting the account himself. Other confirmed retweeters were a Breitbart reporter, a couple of MPs, and someone from Celebrity Big Brother, but I'll leave it to y'all to guess who that might be.
Thank you, Charles. Yeah, it's interesting. I really noticed that on Sunday. I noticed various conservative political commentators, if not retweeting, tweeting that line, the hashtag defund the BBC. So it's definitely something to keep an eye on. And John, perhaps you could tell us a little bit about what's caught your attention in the last few days and what's been happening at Infotagen.
Yeah, Damien, sure. So probably not a surprise to everyone that I'm going to pick up a few claims that have been made about Bill Gates. He's usually quite popular with some of the fact checks that we get sent in. So two claims this week, somewhat contrasting in nature, but we'll go with them. So one is that, did Bill Gates bribe Nigeria to test vaccines on children? And the other one was, does Bill Gates make The Guardian promote vaccines? So just on The Guardian one, first and foremost, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation are one of the funders of The Guardian website, but I don't think they have any say in terms of the content. So that's actually false, even though we had a Twitter comment that said otherwise. And then on the flip side of that, the claim that Bill Gates was bribing Nigeria to test vaccines on children was made in the seminal news website naturalnews.com, which I advise anyone to have a look at if they want to see some interesting content, but false content. So again, that's completely false. The Nigerian House representatives have been considering the Infectious Diseases Control Bill, which the article makes reference to. It has been controversial, as some perceive that it gives too much power to the Nigerian Center for Disease Control. However, it's got nothing at all to do with Bill and Melinda Gates. They have helped fund some work on vaccines in Africa through the Africa Centers for Disease Control, but this has nothing to do with them, and so therefore it's false, as we would expect. But you know, just goes to show, you know, Bill Gates is always a sort of a popular target for misinformation on our site, and we just got to keep fact checking what we get sent through.
Thanks a lot, Don. Just to be clear, we should probably be clear as well that Bill Gates doesn't fund our activity, even though there's no direct link.
Not yet.
We ask.
But fortunately, I think it's been a fascinating discussion. We carry this on for hours, but we're slightly running out of time. But before we do finish, I just wanted to ask Yael if you could just give us your insight on Facebook. And for the issues that we've discussed, the issues that you yourself have raised with them, you know, why do you think they're not acting in the way that we might like, or taking more responsibility over these issues? Is it for commercial reasons? Is it philosophical? What is it that kind of that eats away at the heart of Facebook?
Thank you. I'm glad you circled back with that very question. Listen, you know, for so many years, we've all tried to reinvent the story of who is Mark Zuckerberg. Everyone tries to get in his mind. Everyone tries to say, what is he thinking? I think he's been 100% transparent about who he is all along. He is seeking domination. He is seeking power. And I think it's power more than money, personally. And so all of the recent actions are all about ensuring that his platform remains the dominant, powerful force in the world. But if I can just say, and I won't, we're out of town, so I won't get into all my thoughts on Section 230. Jason and I think very much agree on that. But I do want to say we have an election that is coming up in November, and it will be a consequential one for the United States. And after the 2016 elections, we heard Mark and Sheryl do the apology tour, do the nobody could have seen this coming, nobody could have known this was going to happen, we know we have to do better. Right now, with the actions of the past 6 months at the hands of Mark Zuckerberg, he is setting up a situation where a political operative, including the President of the United States of America, in the 11th hour, what one might call the October surprise, will be able to engage in pure, unadulterated voter suppression tactics through political advertising, through his online posts. If Facebook decides to continue what they're doing now, they will allow it to happen. And I do 100% believe it could affect the election. So I want everybody to remember these conversations when, come December and January of next year, Mark Zuckerberg says, oh, we couldn't have seen this was going to happen. We are so sorry. We know we need to do better. Currently, Facebook has solved for the problem of 2016, and they are not solving for the problems and threats of 2020. And that is allowing political candidates to lie, to promote violence, to engage in voter suppression, unchecked and amplified. And that's where I agree with Jason 100%. Section 230 is not about telling Mark Zuckerberg what content he should or should not allow on the platform. It's about telling him, we want to know how your algorithms are boosting and amplifying this content. We want to know what it is that makes this platform so incredibly ripe for disinformation and hateful content to spread.
Thank you so much, Yael. That's a really important point on which to finish. And as you say, you know, I think the message is there, they're loud and clear, and we have to judge companies like Facebook by their actions and how they respond to that challenge and make sure that we are continuing to be vocal about it, which we'll certainly try and do here. Yael, Jason, thanks so much for joining us for the podcast. It's been a fascinating discussion. And Charles and John, it's great to have you with us as always. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Infotagent podcast, hosted by me, Damien Collins, featuring Yael Eisenstadt, Jason Kint, Charles Creel, and John Quinlan. It was produced by Lucy and David Dargahi. You can find out more about Infotagent, the independent COVID-19 fact-checking service recommended by Ofcom, and send us examples of disinformation you've seen by visiting our website, infotagent.com, or using hashtag IsolateTheLies on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Thank you. Until next time.